We have been working our way through Exodus. Amazing story, challenging story in a lot of ways. Exodus is the story of the exit or departure of a group of slaves from the ancient country of Egypt, and it's a very unusual story because the creator himself inserts himself in the story and directly intervenes to save those people. I've been encouraging you to be reading in Genesis and Exodus so that you can have the backstory to this story we've been reading in Exodus. So if you haven't done that, encourage you to do it. It's a really fascinating story. So just start at the beginning of Genesis and just start reading, and it'll pull you in. Fascinating story of how God reveals himself to people and begins to work out his kingdom on the earth. So if you're like me, even if you've been reading this story through the week, and even if you're somewhat familiar with it, when we start talking about it like we're doing right now on a Sunday, it takes a while for your brain to catch up with the story. So why don't we just review the backstory together and just to get us up to speed with where we're at. So let's start with Abraham and get up to the end. The middle of chapter two. So does anybody want to take a stab at this? I've been doing it a couple times. I didn't prepare this part because I want to do it live like the rest of you. Does anybody want to take a stab at unmuting your mic and just telling us what's the backstory? So we're at the place where Moses is now growing up in the court of Pharaoh. Who can tell us what the backstory is? Tell you what, if you do this, I will give you a $5 Timmy's card. Because it takes a lot of jam to do this. This is something they do in Discovery Bible studies. It's because this is stories stick in our minds. And historically, we've been very oral. Increasingly, we rely on the printed word, but actually recounting the story verbally, orally helps it to stick in your mind. So does anybody want to take a crack at just giving us the little backstory leading up to where we're at in chapter two with Moses growing up in Pharaoh's court? Anybody? If not, you'll have to listen to me take a stab at it. And I'm going to go buy myself coffee. It doesn't have to be perfect. Just unmute your mic, give it a shot, and then we'll fill in the details when you're done. Anybody want to try? Okay, we got it. We have a volunteer. Yoav, are you up for this? Okay, Yoav's giving it a shot. Go ahead, Yoav. We're all listening.
What story are we on right now? Okay, go ahead.
The way I remember it is Moses was found in basket on the river.
Yeah.
His family put him there.
Yeah.
And then somebody who was related to the ruler of Egypt found him. They brought him into the king's court, sort of.
Any other details you remember, Yoav? Yoav, do you remember why the baby's mom put him in the basket and put him on the river? What?
Because King soldiers were looking for all the baby, for all the babies, baby boys, I think.
Yeah, you got it. Hey, Yoav, you rocked it, man. That is really, really good. Good job. Thank you. Super job. So I'll drop that off this afternoon at your house, Yoav, okay? Me give you that Timmy's gift card. Good job. So anybody any other details that anybody wants to fill in that you think are pretty that you think are important to the story? So at the very least, like Yoav said, there's something unusual going on with this boy, and we recognize that this is a really terrible story because Pharaoh is out of his own economic interest and out of their desire to out of their fear of the fact that the Hebrew people are growing, they enslave them, they oppress them, And in order to try to reduce them, to grind them down, Pharaoh is trying to kill all the Hebrew boys. So this is a really terrible, terrible situation. But in the midst of it, we have some anticipation because God seems to be up to something by delivering this little Hebrew child and putting him in the court of Pharaoh. So that's where we ended up. And we're going to start today at chapter 2, verse 11. And I'm going to read this story to you. And then we're going to talk about it just a little bit. So here's the story. This is coming right out of Exodus chapter 2. So remember, Pharaoh's daughter, not only she adopted Moses, she took Moses into her family. And we said, isn't it ironic that here Pharaoh is trying to kill all the Hebrew boys and his own daughter hasn't been convinced by Pharaoh's arguments that the Hebrew boys should die, and she takes in this Hebrew boy. Okay, so many years later, when Moses had grown up, he went out to visit his own people, the Hebrews, and he saw how hard they were forced to work. During his visit, he saw an Egyptian beating one of his fellow Hebrews. After looking in all directions to make sure no one was watching, Moses killed the Egyptian and hid the body in the sand. The next day, when Moses went out to visit his people again, he saw two Hebrew men fighting. Why are you beating up your friend? Moses said to the one who had started the fight. The man replied, who appointed you to be our prince and judge? Are you going to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday? Then Moses was afraid, thinking, everyone knows what I did. And sure enough, Pharaoh heard what had happened, and he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in the land of Midian. He probably had to walk well over 100K to get there. When Moses arrived in Midian, he sat down beside a well. Now, the priest of Midian had seven daughters who came as usual to draw water and fill the water troughs for their father's flocks. But some other shepherds came and chased them away. So Moses jumped up and rescued the girls from the shepherds. Then he drew water for their flocks. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked, why are you back so soon today? An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds, they answered. And then he drew water for us and watered our flocks. Then where is he? Their father asked. Why did you leave him there? Invite him to come and eat with us. Moses accepted the invitation and he settled there with him. In time, Reuel gave Moses his daughter Zipporah to be his wife. Later, she gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, for he explained, I am a foreigner, I have been a foreigner in a foreign land. Years passed, and the king of Egypt died, but the Israelites continued to groan under their burden of slavery. They cried out for help, and their cry rose to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He looked down on the people of Israel and knew it was time to act. So this story, we've already said, it's no wonder this has made it to Hollywood, but this story doesn't go the way it's supposed to go, or at least not the way Moses would think it should have gone, I don't think. So there's this big gap. In verse 10, we end with Moses being adopted into Pharaoh's household through his daughter, Pharaoh's daughter, and then now Moses is a young man, fully grown, and we're left to fill in the details. So what do we know? It's helpful if we to understand the story, just to think a little bit about what the Bible actually tells us. Well, we know that Moses was adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, and so it would seem that he's raised as an Egyptian prince and would have had the best education and advantages and privileges of Pharaoh's court. Some of you will have seen The Prince of Egypt, for sure. So was he a prince? Most likely he was some kind of prince. This raises many questions that we can only speculate about. But here's a few of the questions. Did Moses' adoptive mother tell him of his Hebrew origins? Did Moses have any contact with his birth mother and family? Was Moses accepted within the family of Pharaoh, or did Pharaoh only begrudgingly allow Moses to eat at his table and receive the privileges of royalty because he loved his daughter and because his daughter loved him? What kind of tensions did Moses grow up with? What we do know for sure in the story is that somewhere along the way, Moses came to understand who he was. Twice the narrator tells us this: Moses went out to observe the Hebrew people and saw that they were his own people. He identifies himself with the Hebrews. So I wonder, what conflicts did this set up for Moses as he wrestled with who he was as the son of a Hebrew slave woman who, by some act of God, found himself living as a prince in the palace of Pharaoh, king of Egypt? You wonder what was going on in Moses' mind. So imagine this with me just for a minute. You're a young man or a young woman living in royalty, and yet day by day or month by month, you see all around you your own people being subjected to brutal slavery at the hands of your own adopted family and people. And you live in privilege day by day, and yet you know that the people around you grind their lives away in this brutal slave labor. So what would you do? What do you think that did to Moses? It would seem from the story that for Moses, it grated on him. That injustice festered within him. We're not told. Did he try to use any of his influence to try to change what was happening with imperial slavery policy within Egypt? And I wonder if he fantasized a bit, as young men are prone to do, about what it might look like for him to deliver his people. And I personally wonder how many times Moses may have imagined what it would be like to strike back at an Egyptian slave driver as that slave driver drove one of his fellow Hebrews to exhaustion. So one day Moses goes out, as the story goes, to watch his people at their hard labor. And before he knows it, he sees that the situation that he's played out in his mind actually happens. And before he knows this, he's actually risen up, killed an Egyptian, and buried him in the sand. And then the next day he goes out again to observe what is happening. And this time Moses sees two Hebrews fighting. Again, Moses' sense of justice rises up within him and he intervenes. This time he doesn't kill anyone, but he interrupts the two Hebrews as they're fighting with each other. I think what happens next was a shock to Moses. He might have been expecting some respect from his fellow Hebrews, but if anything, they mock him. And I think this is a turning point in the story. They say, "Who made you ruler and judge over us?" Who made you ruler and judge over us? They don't recognize Moses as one of them. Remember, he's grown up with all the privileges of Egyptian royalty. And at the very least, they don't recognize him as someone they should follow or respect. They want nothing to do with him. So Moses realizes that word is out, that it's known that he's an ally to the Hebrew slaves, and that Pharaoh wants him dead, and so he flees for his life. So when's the last time you failed miserably at something? Something that mattered. Something that was important to your sense of who you were, to your identity, or something that was important to your sense of what you thought God's call was on your life, and you tried to do something about it, and it totally failed. How did you sort that out? Or maybe you're still sorting that out. I would think that any dreams that Moses had for his life didn't include running for his life from Pharaoh and also feeling rejected by his own people. And so Moses finds himself alone, running through the desert, fleeing for his life. So after days of walking and maybe running, Moses ends up at a well in Midian. So Midian is to the east of Egypt, and wells were common community meeting places. It'd be like the post office in small town Saskatchewan. That's what wells are like, because everybody's got to go there to get their mail. And at a well, everybody's got to go to get their water. So that's where you go to meet people and get water. So I got to laugh as a daughter of four as I read the story of Reuel, the Midianite dad. So he his daughters, it would seem he doesn't have any sons. Seven of his daughters are looking after his sheep. So all seven of them come to the well to water their flocks. So I got four daughters, seven daughters. That's a lot of hair. Every one of them probably is unique. My four daughters, all of them have different colors of hair. It's all long. No exaggeration, when they're living in my house, every month I've got to take the vacuum cleaner head and I've got to use scissors to cut out the hair because my wife has a thick head of hair and all my daughters had a thick head of hair. And of course, I'm buying the fertilizer for this, right? All of the conditioner and shampoo. I don't know why I didn't buy shares in Shoppers early on, but we did. So that's a lot of hair. It's amazing how much hair these young women can produce. So you can imagine Moses resting by the well, and the seven daughters of Reuel approach and are harassed by the local shepherds as they try to water their father's sheep. Moses could have just let it go. He's just intervened twice in two situations of injustice, and both times it doesn't turn out well. But as he watches these foreign shepherds who he doesn't know mistreat these young women who he also doesn't know, for some reason, Moses can't put up with it. He's in the middle of nowhere. Why should he care? Like, really? Why should he care? And he's by himself, far from home. He should probably be careful. But he doesn't. He intervenes again. So even from a distance, we can't help but see that there's something going on in Moses that is good. He has this sense of justice rooted in his person. Like, we can speculate. Some of this may have just been part of his genetic makeup. It's in the marrow of his bones. But some of it, too, may have been nurtured by growing up in Pharaoh's palace as a Hebrew slave and witnessing day after day and year after year injustice happening in the society around him. Either way, Moses has this sense of justice that's just become part of who he is. And so he stands up and single-handedly rescues these seven daughters of Reuel from these local shepherds. So this guy's an initiator. He doesn't lack courage. I would say he's an activist. He's wired to take action and to intervene in the face of injustice to try to make things right. So what happens next in the story? So when the shepherd girls get home to their dad, Reuel is incredulous. Like, he can't believe what's just happened. I could just imagine him saying, "Girls, what are you doing? You know how short of eligible men we are around here. All there is more shepherds. And this official-looking guy who seems to have some decency about him rescues you from the harassment of the local men, and you don't even invite him over for dinner? Go get cleaned up, and then some of you go and invite him over for supper." So Moses finds himself sitting at the table with Reuel and his seven daughters. I wonder how long it took Moses to think, okay, maybe life in Midian isn't going to be so bad. Maybe it took him a while, maybe not. It would have made for some interesting dynamics, I'm sure. In time, Moses marries Zipporah, and he has a son that they call Gershom, which sounds like Hebrew for alien or alien there. So Moses found himself living in exile, settling down to raise a family, a would-be deliverer who's living far away from his own people and their own struggles. I wonder if Moses at this point lived with a sense of failure, of missed opportunity, of somehow missing God's plan and purpose for his life. And yet, as we look at the bigger story, we see that God is preparing this guy through these hard experiences, through his failure, and with the passage of time. But then that brings us to the last two verses of this passage and a turning point in the story. Let me read them to you again. Just listen to these as you think about your own situation and the situation of our world. "Many years later, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned under their slavery and cried out. Their cries for relief from their hard labor ascended to God. God listened to their groanings. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw what was going on with Israel. God understood. God listened. God remembered. God saw. God understood. Do you see the flow of the story? We have this child who's condemned to die. He gets delivered by what seems to be an act of God. The hope of the reader is that, okay, here we have a deliverer, someone who's going to come and set the people of the Israelite people free from their slavery, and he screws it up somehow. It doesn't go the way we think it's supposed to go. Hope is lost. And then we come to this phrase, God listened, God remembered, God saw, and God understood. The Hebrew people don't even pray to God. All they do is they groan. Their cries are lifted up. And God sees, and God hears, and God understands. And that brings us to the end of our passage for today. So, a couple questions for us to consider. From our perspective as followers of Jesus, how has God heard, remembered, seen, and understood? As we think of, we're part of this story. This was at the beginning of God's story of deliverance through Jesus. We are now followers of Jesus. How has God heard, remembered, seen, and understood? How has God acted on behalf of the world? Seems to me that God has been at work to deliver people and the creation itself from evil in all its forms that keeps us in all kinds of slavery. It's not just the Hebrews, but also the Egyptians that need deliverance, and it's us that needs deliverance too. Our world needs deliverance. And Jesus came to give us life and life to the full. And by that, we hear a life of service, a life of love, a life of sacrifice that's lived out so that other people can experience God's love and justice and mercy and forgiveness as well. And of course, following Jesus isn't a one-time decision, but a process of following his teaching and allowing him to lead us into that kind of a life. So Jesus has, God has heard, he has seen, and he's in the process of delivering. Tim Keller says this about the gospel. He says the gospel can be summarized in three words. Jesus saves us. We don't save ourselves. Jesus delivers us in many different ways, but at the heart of the story of the Bible is that we are all in need of deliverance, and Jesus is that deliverer. So then that brings me to a second question. What are you crying out for? What groans are coming out of your heart as you think about your own life or as you think about the world around us? Who are you crying out to? So what are you crying out for? Who are you crying out to as you think about this story? Lord, thank you that you're a God who sees, you're a God who listens, you're a God who understands. You're also a God who has acted and is acting to bring hope, to bring deliverance, to bring freedom into our lives. Thank you for all of that. Thank you for the gift of Jesus, the ultimate deliverer, who has come and walked with us, walked among us, identified completely with our situation and our pain and our brokenness and our human weakness. Thank you, Jesus, for all of that and for giving yourself for us. Help us to follow you in a new way. We ask you to forgive us where we've lost sight of you this last week, where we've gone our own way rather than thinking about what it means to follow you and to love you first. So we just want to renew our desire to trust in you and follow you this week. For those of us that are particularly discouraged, who are groaning under burdens that are too heavy for us to bear, I just pray encouragement and hope. We think of people around us in our city and in our world who live without hope and knowledge of you. And I just pray that your kingdom would come in this world, both practically, and that your kingdom would come, Lord, that they would come to know who you are and your great love for them. And I pray you'd give us opportunities even this week to share that love in word and in deed with people around us. Lord, help us not to be ashamed of you. Because you're so good and you're so kind and you're so loving. And you're bringing in a kingdom that's good and just and whole and peaceful. Thank you for that. May that hope just burn in our hearts, even in the face of so much in our world that isn't that way, and even so much in our lives sometimes that isn't that way. Pray your blessing on each one that's here today, God, and those who can't be here today. In your name, amen.